What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper, and I'm here with, of course, my co-host.
Hey, everybody, it's Gabe Pacheco.
Now, as you guys know, you can hear the Katie Halper Show on iTunes. You can hear the Katie Halper Show on SoundCloud. And when you're on iTunes, you gotta rate and review us. It's so easy. It takes like 3 seconds.
Yeah, that's the gift that keeps on giving. So for this holiday season, why don't you, if you like what you're hearing, give us a 5-star rating and write something nice for us.
Yeah, it takes no time at all. Also, you know what you could do for the holidays is give yourself the gift of Katie Halper Show bonus content. That means extended interviews. That also means totally extra bonus interviews. We're going to do that on today's show. You're going to love it. We got some, not to brag, but we finally got Naomi Klein. Wonderful guest we've been trying to get.
Love Naomi Klein.
Love Naomi Klein. And to do that, you just go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. And you just donate $5 a month and you get all of this extra content. $5 a month is less than a drink, depending on the type of drink. If you drink a beer, I guess it's maybe more. Not really, not in New York City, not if you go out.
Yeah, it's a cup of coffee.
It's a cup of coffee. So I'm not saying deprive yourself of a cup of coffee because that could make you dysfunctional. That would do that to me. I was at an event the other day and they were fundraising around something and the woman was like, I realized that it's just the price of the New Yorker and I'm going to quit my subscription to the New Yorker. So guys, quit your subscription to the New Yorker.
Yeah. Support independent media.
Yeah. Not the New Yorker. Yeah.
Supporters. We have no corporate sponsors.
We have no corporate sponsors. Yeah.
We're not beholden to any special interest groups.
Exactly.
So you're going to get that raw, uncut. You know,
unfiltered, unbought, and unbossed, as Nina Turner quotes Shirley Chisholm for saying.
I thank her for being unbought and unbossed, and I'm cut from that same cloth.
Speaking of Nina Turner,
I am Nina Turner, just in case folks don't know. And I'm the president of Our Revolution, and we are certainly proud to be a sponsor, one of the sponsors of the Sanders Institute, The Gathering. And I'm so glad that the Sanders Institute has brought this happy family together.
I had the fortune of attending the Sanders Institute's Gathering, and this was in Burlington.
Progressives, including some from the big screen, descending on Burlington this week. They'll be breaking down left-leaning issues like universal health care.
Hispanic people, the voices of Asian people, the voices of African-American people. Those voices have to be a part of this. Yeah.
Actors Danny Glover and Susan Sarandon making the trip, alongside activists like Cornel West.
Yeah, this is a gathering, but this is not any gathering. This is the Sanders Institute.
And political leaders, too.
So these are not radical ideas. Unless you think that justice for all is a radical idea.
San Juan Mayor Carmen Cruz says she wants not only to focus on the ideas themselves,
but make sure that the progressive agenda materializes in concrete legislative action.
So the Sanders Institute is an institute that was founded by Jane Sanders, the wife of Bernie Sanders.
What we can do, come up with bold ideas and move forward.
And the gathering comes at a time when a lot of people in this room are wondering about the keynote speaker.
Today is, you know, good news and bad news.
Bernie 2020.
Will the Vermont senator make another run at the White House?
If he has the best chance to defeat President Trump, and if he thinks that he is, then he'll probably run. If he thinks that there's somebody else that can do it better, he'll probably support them.
Jane Sanders says this conference isn't associated with the campaign. Her husband says it's about continuing to have their ideas come out of the shadows.
But it was a great event. Roseanne DeMauro was there from the National Nurses Union.
The work that I've done in my life in the labor movement is some of the work that I'm the most proud of in my life.
The mayor of San Juan was there. The mayor of Barcelona, Ada Colau, who is the first female mayor of Barcelona.
And we decide to start at local level because the politics of austerity and corruption had destroyed the credibility of public institutions. We needed to provide real and concrete solutions through actions that change people's lives, because the local level is the best place to improve democracy.
Susan Sarandon.
Now we have this swell of millennials and younger that are going to vote for the first time also in 2020. Our education system is not giving them a context, is not giving them history, really, from a point of view that is relevant, anyway. And they just know that we've messed up. And now they're demanding answers, and they're demanding candidates, and they're not interested in who the parties as much as the issues, which is a good thing.
Danny Glover was there.
What?
Yeah, Danny Glover was there. He was on a bunch of panels. Friend of the show, Ben Jealous, was there.
Yep.
You prioritize organizing from the bottom up. You prioritize controlling states. Well, eventually you control Congress because you control redistricting. You're building a bench to run for all kinds of offices across the state. Well, then you have an incredible bench to run for the federal government. And so in this moment, I would encourage us not to despair because we don't control our federal government. It's great that we've taken back the House, and I want to thank everybody who's a part of that. But we all know until you have the Senate and the presidency, you can't get a whole lot done. And we have to get a whole lot done. And I would say we have no choice but to make our cities, as Bernie did here, our counties, our states, models for the rest of our country. We root this movement in our cities, in our counties, in our states. And while the work will feel harder in some ways, and we'll be focused to, you know, give our $5 or our $27 to more candidates and more places and be organizing all the time and not just for the federal cycles, what we'll find is that we move further, faster.
And also, Fernando Haddadi, who lost the election in Brazil to Bolsonaro, who's the fascist.
Yes.
He was there. Jim Zogby.
One final thing I have to say. Something happened that I really can't let go without talking about. Mark Lamont Hill was fired from CNN. He was fired from CNN for a speech he gave at the UN where he talked about equal rights and human rights for everybody from the river to the sea. People who didn't want to hear that tried to make it into something it wasn't. And Mark Lamont Hill paid a price. Not only did he pay a price, but civil discourse pays a price. And the ability to talk about complicated issues pays a price. If we can't talk about Israel-Palestine, if we can't talk about Syria, if we can't talk about, because you've paid a price for that, if we can't talk about race, if we can't talk about immigration policy without jumping on people who disagree and trying to make something out of it that it's not, and criminalize or weaponize our intolerance, then we all pay a price as a country. I'll never forget Bernie for was meet the press one morning after having met with him and talked about issues. He said, they said, who advises you on foreign policy? And he said, Jim Zogby. And I said to my wife, holy shit. Holy shit. I said, I actually used that word. I said, and that's civil. Because I'd always been, I'd worked for different presidential candidates and stuff, but it was like, well, I don't know him. It's like, who's he? You know, whatever. Like, give me the Arab money or give me the Arab votes, but don't talk to me about, you know, I'm not going to acknowledge you publicly. Bernie had the courage to not only acknowledge me publicly, but do me and J Street and others on both sides of the issue, and then ask me to serve on the platform drafting committee, and respect the fact that I had an ability to talk about Medicare for all, and to talk about my biggest victory was we won something. We suckered the Clinton people into it, ending the death penalty, because we actually had the vote. Gus remembers it. We had the vote for it, and then they immediately called for a suspension of the vote after we were winning, because they wanted to bring their people out in caucus, because it was not Hillary's position. But what happened was, when they came back, I said to the chair, I said, well, it looks like they're back now. Have you whipped your people into line? And they were so embarrassed that they ended up saying, okay, you got it. But that sense of that Bernie was respectful of people with points of view that had not been brought together, that he tried to convene us, as we're doing this weekend, convening people of diverse points of view from a progressive side that can elevate discourse.
John Cusack.
That's right, from Say Anything fame.
Yeah, yeah.
And Con Air. He was also in Con Air.
And High Fidelity.
That's right. And The Paperboy, which I love.
Paperboy, I don't think I ever saw that.
That's not a big deal.
All right.
It's a film.
Was it good?
Loved it.
80s, 90s?
It's 2000s.
Oh, okay, more recent.
Sure.
Oh, wait, is that really scary movie that takes place in Florida in the Everglades?
Where you going, Paperboy? Ain't nobody out of this.
Yeah, Matthew McConaughey's in it.
Oh, my God, that is a bizarre movie.
Nicole Kidman.
I really just wanted to thank you for helping me get Hillary out of that hellhole.
Well, I wouldn't go booking honeymoon just yet.
Oh.
But we are going to fight incident in the way it came about.
Yes, it is so weird, and it came out of nowhere, and Zac Efron.
That's right. I think Lee Daniels directed it.
Yeah, so yeah. Who did The Butler.
That's it. Yeah, yeah.
Which I haven't seen.
No, but everybody should see The Paperboy if you want to be disturbed.
Yeah, it's a great movie to not see with the family. It's a really disturbing movie, and John Cusack plays a gator hunter, and there's a really weird stuff going on with Matthew McConaughey.
I think Lee Daniels just does a great job of getting celebrities to really perform at their ugliest.
Yeah.
In a good way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
He gets maximum vulnerability from his actors.
Yes. I never would have expected that Matthew McConaughey would play a character like the character he does, which is kind of like a fresh-faced pretty boy who then we learn has basically is gay and into S&M. And then, as I guess can happen with S&M, gets taken advantage of, because I guess once you're tied up, it's easier to be taken advantage of.
That's right.
That's just a law of physics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was there. John Cusack was there.
Yeah. And also he was in The Cradle Will Rock, not to be confused with The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, which is like a horror film.
The Hand That Rocks the Cradle is the hand that rules the world.
But The Cradle Will Rock, and I bring that up because it's actually about the WPA and all this art under FDR.
Broadway, 1936.
It was a time when artists like Orson Welles, John Houseman, and Diego Rivera were changing the rules.
It's great. It's with Susan Sarandon.
I support your art, but that does not mean that I must support your revolution.
And John Cusack actually plays Rockefeller.
I'm Nelson Rockefeller. I've chosen your sketch to be included in the lobby of the Rockefeller Center.
And it's directed by Tim Robbins. So it's a very progressive endeavor. It's a great movie. So yeah, John Cusack was there. Susan Sarandon was there. I got some great interviews. And I didn't tell you the biggest part, the biggest deal of this whole thing, Gabe, which is that guess who I finally got an interview with? Who is the someone I talk about quite a bit?
Mark Ruffalo.
No, but he's someone I do talk about quite a bit. Someone who was the gathering was kind of shaped around.
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders. I finally got it. Thank you so much for talking to me. And one of the things that's really frustrating for progressives who support you is this narrative about you not being a feminist or you being anti-racist. How can we push back on that, given how much the corporate media seems to be interested in that narrative?
Look, the corporate media will do anything and everything they can to protect their own interests and say anything about anybody that they want. What we are fighting for is to bring people together, Black and white and Latino, Native American and Asian American, around an agenda that speaks to the needs of ordinary Americans and not just the 1%. And the only way we succeed is when we bring people together.
Right.
And I think there are many people in the establishment, in the corporate media, who are getting very nervous. They're getting nervous now because all of us, Black and white and Latino, you know what we want? We want Medicare for all. Right. We want to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. We don't want our kids to be living in a planet ravaged by climate change. So we are making progress. We expect opposition to continue. We're going to do the best in this fight that we can.
And why is the media so interested in why do you think they're so threatened?
Well, because it's Which obvious as to who owns the media. Right. You know, when you look at corporate media, you're looking at media owned by large corporate, often international corporate conglomerates who are owned by some of the wealthiest people in this country or in the world. They do not want progressive change in this country. They do not want the wealthiest people to start paying their fair share of taxes. They do not want us to end fossil fuel production in this country. Yeah. So they have conflict.
And I just want to say, as a feminist, we love Bernie Sanders, and we think you're a big feminist, not just because of your stances on issues like reproductive rights, but also because of your economic and anti-war policies, which we know help women and people of color disproportionately. So I really want to thank you for that. Sorry, I couldn't help doing my little spiel, but something I've been wanting to tell the senator for a while. That was Bernie Sanders.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I'm really happy I got that. It was a little embarrassing. I was fangirling out a little bit. So, finally got it.
Yeah. You've achieved it.
I've achieved it. I'd like to...
interviewed the boss. That's the boss of the level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I spoke to St. Bernard.
Yeah. Do you feel changed? Do you feel different?
Like a changed woman? A little bit. I mean, what I'm hoping, Gabe, is that I don't want you to treat me any differently.
Right. Now that you've flown so close to the sun.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to keep myself grounded.
Right. It's hard, though.
It's hard. Yeah. I mean, I definitely understand how Icarus felt.
Yeah. You're hashtag blessed as well.
Yeah. I just don't want to alienate our listeners. I don't want people to treat me differently.
You've gone Hollywood.
I've gone Hollywood. Yeah. He is so funny. Like, he's just walking around like a normal guy.
Sure.
Yeah, it was kind of adorable. I overheard him giving an interview to The Real News, and he was talking about, like, Lloyd Blankfein. He's like, that was, you know what chutzpah is? It was chutzpah.
This is chutzpah. You want to hear chutzpah?
Which is cute. And he was kind of crotchety in the lovable way that he is. He's like, all right, let's get going. We got to get going, you know, with the interviews.
Sure. Not into glad handing.
No, not into glad handing at all. Yeah. One of the people, by the way, I didn't get to interview was the mayor of Barcelona. So you're on notice, Ada Colau. But one of the best things, and I'm going to try to get an interview with Yanis, not the musician,
yeah,
but the guy from Greece,
okay,
the finance minister,
yeah,
who's like considered really sexy. But it was cool. They released at this institute, the Sanders Institute, they released
the bold international Green New Deal that we will work together to deliver. It is time for progressives of the world to unite. Today, on behalf of DiEM25 and the Sanders Institute, we issue a call to action to create a global network of individuals and organizations that will fight together for dignity, peace, prosperity, and the future of our planet.
It was a little disorganized. They like tried to show the website and it didn't really pop up at first.
Join the Progressive International by visiting this page. Well, we can't see it.
It was like blocked by things.
Bring it down, someone. It's progressiveinternational.org.
And it was interesting because they were talking all about how, like, we need to organize on an international level. We have all these progressives, Jeremy Corbyn, Bernie Sanders, who's not president yet, but we hope he is. And there isn't like a lot of coordination. So that was the idea.
Sure.
It's exciting. I interviewed Gus Newport, who was the mayor of Berkeley.
I'm 83 now. My granddaughter suggests I'm 4 years older than baseball, but but I feel like my whole life has been involved in police mispractices. My grandmother started taking me at the age of 5. We grew up in Rochester, New York, to see Paul Robeson and Marian Anderson. My grandmother only went as far as the fourth grade because in Virginia, she went to school late after picking cotton one day. A white teacher slapped her. She walked out and never went back. But she became an avid reader. They got married real young those days, so she moved her family, first after my mother was born, to Pittsburgh, where she had cousins, and then on to Rochester. She never told me until I was 26, ahead of the biggest civil rights group in Rochester, New York, after the Black Muslim mosque was invaded, that her mother was a slave. And so I feel like the spiritualization she gave me by exposing me to all these things, it will keep me involved. As an 11-year-old, I was knocked off of a corner by a policeman just for walking because he felt I was walking too slow or whatever else, so I got involved in movements then. My feeling is, under those circumstances, that incarceration, as we know it in this country, is a continuation of slavery. Because when you think about it, we've got new jails on the stock market. You remember, it's the convicts who make the license plates and all that and gets paid 7 cents an hour. As I said, I got to New Malcolm X when I was in Rochester, and the police invaded the Black Muslim mosque. Malcolm called Daisy Bates from Little Rock, Arkansas, who was organizing, said, "I'm coming to Rochester, who should I talk to?" And she gave him my phone number. Malcolm X called me and talked to me every night for 2 hours. I was just speechless. But he flew into Rochester, New York on a very cold February day. And I'm standing in the airport waiting for him. We'd never seen each other. And I'm surrounded by all these white men in white shirts and felt hats. And Malcolm comes through the door and said, "Who is Gus Newport?" I said, "I am, sir." He said, "Young blood, you got the best tap telephone in America. This is all FBI here."
So thank you so much, Mayor Gus Newport. It's really an honor to talk to you. Can you tell us about why you're here? And what this movement is that you're involved in?
I'm here because we're certainly looking for an alternative to the two-party system. I don't have that much faith in, certainly not Republicans, nor Democrats. I was one of the Bernie Eight to the Unity Reform Committee to try to reform the Democrat National Committee, and I found out more about the Democrat Party than I ever wanted to know.
Right.
And including they were founded as the Dixiecrats, and of course, where they are with superdelegates now, the Electoral College and all that stuff. But nobody in the Democrat Party has ever spoken to all the issues in the depth that Bernie Sanders has. In his analysis, and of course, I first met Bernie. We were mayors at the same time. And he and Dennis Kucinich and I used to be invited to Eastern universities to talk about public policy, and Bernie invited me out to Burlington a couple of times, and he also invited me out when he ran for governor. And I don't know if you heard what I said yesterday, but we were sitting in his office the first day that I was here, and a reporter from the UPI and AP were there, and they pulled out this long sheet of paper. And Bernie said, "What is that?" She said, "Well, you know, we can put a public figure's name in, and we got 90 stories on Gus Newport. Bernie, our question is, why you, a Jew from Brooklyn, who's a socialist, invites Gus Newport, a former Black nationalist and a socialist from Berkeley, to run, to campaign with you for governor in a state that's 97% white?" Bernie said, "Because we're going to talk about the issues."
Right.
They had no more questions.
Wow, that's great.
I've loved him ever since, yeah. You know.
What do you think the challenges are for, I mean, there's this myth and this narrative, right, that this is, that socialism is a white project. It's, I don't know if you've heard this, like, it's white male privilege to be talking about these issues. I think that it's a lot because of the media. I've talked about Nina Turner for this. There's a lot about name.
Well, first of all, let me say that the Black church has played somewhat of a negative role because Christianity just hears socialism or communism. They don't know any better. My mother was very active in the church when I was a kid, and when those three young men got killed in Mississippi, she looked, what organization should she join in Rochester, New York? NAACP wasn't doing anything. My mother joined the Communist Party.
Wow.
When my father found out, he almost died.
Wow.
But
But
you must remember, I'm doing a film right now with some people on the last 3 years of Malcolm X. Malcolm was a socialist, and Martin Luther King was moving towards socialism when he talked about the war against Vietnam.
Right.
So they must understand that, but a lot of the black leaders didn't go along. So we've got to educate our own to become an integral part of this.
So how do you see that? How do you see that? Like, what is your role in that, or what are you hoping to do?
Well, Danny Glover and I have been going, we've gone to Mississippi and to South Carolina with Bernie.
Yeah.
Danny can discuss things. We could, and we're going to do it. And if the minute it appears that Bernie's going out there, and I sat next to him at dinner last night. No, I won't say what that, but anyway, we're going to go organize. I'm going into rehab now for this bad knee. I'm 83 years old. But as soon as I do the water walking, I'm going to be ready to campaign 9-10 months out of the year.
Yeah.
So,
the media also has played a major role, right? I mean,
the media, let's face it. We are, the media translate what it wants to do, but look who they work for. CBS, whatever else, that's corporate America.
Right. Yeah. What do you think of a third party? What do you think, what is your hope for the Democrats?
I thought for a long time that we needed a third party, looking at what the two parties do, or at least some. So I think it's necessary. We're looking to find the America that was supposed to be, as Martin Luther King used to say. A democracy we aren't.
Yeah.
A democracy we sort of, the founding fathers weren't about democracy. They were white men who basically wanted themselves trying to get away from the monarchy in Great Britain, come out of here, and took full advantage of the Native Americans and put them on plantations, et cetera, whatever else. The first apartheid situation was created right here in America 300 years ago.
And anything else you want to tell people, listeners?
This was an exciting 3 days.
Yeah.
Jane Sanders needs to be given all the credit in the world for putting this together. And I think the substance of the discussions, et cetera, whatever else, has given all of us a challenge to put ourselves together, and we can focus heavily now, not worrying about what's going to happen between the Republican and Democrat Party, et cetera, whatever
else. Yeah, that's over. We already know,
let's go do that which is in the best interest of our own people, and certainly make sure there's a worthwhile future for the next generation.
Can you just say a few words on neoliberalism and what you think the threat of that is?
Well, you know, I was the mayor of Berkeley for 8 years. I got drafted into politics because I was very active, you know, left wing, etc. It was the neoliberals that turned me off. They are single issue people, but they do not work around other issues. They think, they usually come from third generation wealth, well educated, not a part of the working class, et cetera, whatever else. That's not, we're looking for real people.
I'm so curious more about your dad's response to your mom joining the party.
My dad was an Abe Lincoln Republican.
Oh, wow.
He only reacted for a minute.
Yeah.
My grandmother was very much church too, but my grandmother started taking me to see Paul Robeson when I was 5 years old.
Wow.
So she understood more about socialism and communism than whatever, because her mother was a slave. My great-grandmother was a slave.
And you only found, when did you find that out?
When I was 26 years old, after Malcolm X came to my home to visit me when I was head of a civil rights group. And my grandmother felt that I was ready to accept this responsibility.
So she hadn't told you before?
Yeah, right.
Hadn't. Wow. Speaking of Abraham Lincoln and Paul Robeson, I have family who were in the Spanish Civil War who went to fight against Franco.
Right.
And one of the things I worked on was I made a documentary about this monument built by political prisoners. It's where Franco's buried. It's like disgusting fascist, edifice, whatever. And I met a lot of the guys who had worked on it, and one of the men I met, who was in his 80s, his grandson picked me up at the train station. This was in Spain. And he had never told his grandkids about his working on this monument.
It's like they don't want to share
slavery, but it's not
the
slavery,
bad times
it's not
or whatever else.
Right.
That's what it's all about. Yeah.
And especially there, and their civil war is much more recent, obviously.
Oh, I know. But, I work with a lot of the Abe Lincoln guys. They used to come or out there in Berkeley. We spent a lot of time.
Yeah.
Anyway,
premature anti-fascist, as they're called, right? Well, thank you so much.
Right. Thank you.
Thank
good
you so
luck.
Much for your time.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye.
Okay. Gus Newport. Inspiring.
Oh, yeah. What a guy. What a life he's lived, you know, having hung out with Malcolm X.
I assisted Malcolm X as he left the Muslims.
Mayor.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough to have James Baldwin sitting in the front row at my inauguration.
Berkeley.
I debated Saul Alinsky.
Black nationalists.
Black nationalist, former black nationalist, friend of Bernie's, FOB. But yeah, it's funny. I actually heard him speak at the Democratic Unity Commission. You know, he mentioned he was on that. And he is like much more sympathetic to millennials than a lot of younger people are.
And you got to think of the reality. The millennials just said they'd had enough.
Obviously, there's this like narrative of the spoiled millennial.
I mean, isn't that mostly from the media?
Yeah.
Like, is it, it's generated around like how millennials are like destroying Applebee's or whatever, but it's because they're no one has money.
Right.
Many of them know they won't be able to buy a house in their lifetime. They got to pay these student loans, et cetera, and other things.
So it's not really the millennials that are causing the problems.
Right, right, right.
It's the conditions that they're raised into.
Yeah. It's not that they like avocados.
Because the other thing, history is not recorded in the United States of America. It's propaganda.
But it was just interesting hearing him say that because his finger was so on the pulse. And here's this guy in his 80s.
Yeah.
Who's like feels bad for millennials being trashed.
If we could get past our own egos and look at the issues in the state of our people, because even though we talk about the great things the Democrat Party has done, we are 37th in the world in education. Black America is at its lowest economic edge since the Jim Crow era. The Democrat Party still has a long way to go. I appreciate what we accomplished, but don't go out here bragging too soon when you look at the status of the American people, et cetera, whatever else. And this didn't just happen on Trump's hand. You know, Trump has only been there for a year.
Well, it's you know, it's always the conditions of old people who are in power that make fun of the people who are underneath them who are younger.
Too many of us who get into body politic look eventually just focus on ourselves. You know, we got retirement for life, we got health care for life, but what about the people?
Right.
Because in some ways they're scared of their own death, and they see death in the eyes and a fresh, young, taut skin.
Right.
Of their children and grandchildren.
They see their own death.
That's
mean.
Right.
Yeah.
They see their own death.
Yeah, yeah. And the contrast of it, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
You know, other, it could come in a multitude of different ways.
Yeah.
You know, it could be like when, like a Charlotte's Web type thing where like the mama spider, all the spiders that she gives birth to, like consume her first.
Mm.
You know, how yeah. your kids are going to eat you.
Yeah.
Or it could just be death in general.
Right.
But, yeah, we should never fear the new and the young.
And he's one of the older guys who, like in his 80s, who doesn't fear that.
That's right.
And like credits them.
Yeah, because he's like a human being in touch with himself.
Yeah, he's woke. He stays woke.
And so I say, again, I'm really pleased to have been a part of this. But I'm going out of here with my head held high. But damn sure not going out with the accomplishments that I'd hoped. And I love all y'all. But don't think the job is done. Thank you.
I interviewed the mayor of Stockton, California, who's really young, 28.
I was reflecting last night and I realized the things we fight for were things that were so important to me now, but even more so 20 years ago. So before I was mayor, I was a poor, young, black child on the south side of Stockton with an incarcerated father and a mother who had me at 16 years old as a teenager. So the things we fight for, like affordable health care, affordable child care, entitlement programs like WIC and Head Start all paved the way for me to be on the stage today. So I want to start by thanking all of you, the activists, the thinkers, the organizers, for creating a world that we know is not perfect, but could be worse, and that the fact we're here today is to push and to bend the moral arc of the universe. So I want to start by saying thank you. So Stockton, California is a city in the Central Valley of California. It's about 320,000 people. It's between San Francisco and Sacramento, about an hour and a half away from Silicon Valley, and about an hour away from Sacramento. And it's incredibly diverse. My city is 35 to 40% Latino, 35% white, 10% African American, 15 to 20% Asian. Our city is also ideologically diverse, 60% Democrat, 40% Republican, which means a lot of things we're doing that are progressive aren't happening in liberal bastions, but are happening in tough conversations with people who may not agree with me on every national choice and decision. And to the mayor's point, I think we organized ourselves in Stockton around three main tenets. Number one, that indeed the status quo is unacceptable. And since it is unacceptable, we have a mandate, we have a duty, we have an obligation to do something to make it better. The second tenet that organizes our work is this idea of structural violence. I remember reading Mountains Beyond Mountains, and Dr. Paul Farmer talked about structural violence as the avoidable impairment of basic human needs. So my administration, we organize ourselves around the idea that government can't do everything, but we have to do something to solve structural violence, because I would argue a lot of the violence we see in our streets are just symptoms of a deeper structural issue, that it's no stranger, it's not a surprise that we could pinpoint neighborhoods in every city in this country where you expect to see high rates of gun violence. And why is that? Because they have low rates of literacy, they have more liquor stores and grocery stores, they have more check cashing places and banks, they have zero jobs. They are, as we like to say in Stockton, they're oftentimes high in everything bad and low in everything good. And it's not necessarily the individual choices that people are making. And our third kind of governing and organizing frame in Stockton is, as government, the most important investment we can make is actually in our people. That cities aren't buildings, they aren't stadiums, they aren't new developments, but they're people, flesh and blood people, and all our people. So folks who are rich and folks who are poor, folks who are documented, folks who aren't documented, folks who are young, folks who are old, folks who speak English and folks who are learning, that the only Stockton is nothing more than its people.
Growing up, the narrative was always escaping Stockton, and never saw myself coming back to Stockton. But I was lucky enough to graduate high school, go to Stanford, and I thought I hit the lotto. That's gonna make a lot of money. And then I entered in the White House, so my job was working in intergovernmental affairs. So I just worked with mayors and councils all day, every day, and I saw progress happening at a local level in the way it wasn't happening at the federal level. Because this was in 2010, when the Tea Party had just taken back the House, and we thought that was the worst thing ever. If only we knew what was down the pipe.
Yeah.
And then around the same time, one of my cousins was a victim of a homicide in Stockton, and that kind of murder caused me to think about what did success mean if it was only for me.
Mm.
So then I decided the next year to run for city council in my old neighborhood. Did that for 4 years, had some wins, but it still didn't feel like enough. It was like, what can we do citywide? How do we just not reframe the conversation about a neighborhood or a district, but reframe the face, the dialogue, and the narrative around the city? So then I was crazy enough at 26 to decide to run for mayor, and it's been 2 years.
Wow. And what brings you to the Sanders Institute?
I think the issues that the Sanders Institute cares about, from healthcare, the environment, criminal justice, et cetera, are things that are super important to the people I represent in Stockton. Mm-hmm. So I'm here just to learn and hear what bright minds are thinking and to lend my voice and my support for causes that would advance sort of our nation towards this idea of a more perfect union.
Right. And what are the other issues? I mean, what did you, were you inspired by Sanders in 2016? What was your...
I especially appreciated the fact that Senator Sanders came and spoke in Stockton during the presidential campaign, which was unheard of for someone running for president to come to Stockton. And I was able to introduce him. And I was also impressed with the number of people who were at that rally in the middle of the day, like 5,000-6,000 people. And Stockton's a super rabid political town. So I was like, wow, this message is resonating. And I think that gave me the confidence to be a little more bold in my policies, prescriptions, or the pilot programs, et cetera, we're doing in the city, because I saw just the hunger and the want for a government that actually is responsive and works for regular, everyday people.
Right. What was the most disappointing thing that you saw when you were working for the White House?
The most disappointing thing I saw was just how politics is often divorced from, like, everyday people. Like, the conversations we would have would be in theory without... I mean, we're talking about extended unemployment benefits. And it was tough because it was in exchange for extending the Bush-era tax cuts as well, I think. But some of the most... Even the people for or against it... I remember I spoke up in one meeting and said, well, I don't have a decision in this, but I just know my cousin... it's kind of her unemployment is insurance for Christmas.
Right.
So whatever we could do to make sure she gets that, I think we should take that seriously. And there's a lot of, so it's not her, because right after the recession, so there's a lot of people who have been on unemployment insurance for the last year and announced the holidays. So how do we make sure? And I realize that so much of policy is done in theory, but divorced from, like, the lives of everyday people.
Right. So it lacks the urgency and, like, compassion
that
is needed, right?
Absolutely.
And what are you working on now?
So in Stockton, we're working on a bunch of things, but the big three things are, number one, the universal scholarship program called Stockton Scholars, where every kid who graduates from our largest school district is guaranteed a scholarship to a community college, trade school, or a four-year institution. Number two, a gun violence reduction program called Advanced Peace, where we're targeting the guys who are most likely to be victims and perpetrators of violent crime, but targeting them with the same attention from resources as they currently get from cops. And see if that investment decision yields different outcomes. And we've seen a 35-40% reduction in shootings and homicides this year. And then the third thing that people talk about the most is what we're calling the Stockton Economic Empowerment Demonstration, which is a guaranteed income pilot. We're starting in February, 100 families for at least 18 months will be given $500 a month to test the efficacy of a guaranteed income to help stabilize people in times of financial volatility.
And what do you think about the relationship between, that's often presented as divorce, between race and class, gender and class, gender and race?
we absolutely have to be intersectional in how we think about things, because it's not just one thing, but it's one thing in concert with the other. And I would argue that a lot of the things we're fighting against stem from this idea of white supremacy. I think there's patriarchy rooted in that. There's racism. There's class. It's all rooted in this idea. So we have to be intersectional in how we think about policies and programs. And I think we also have to be comfortable to creating the space to have, because these are hard conversations. Right. These are like very difficult conversations to have. But to get to solutions, I think we have to have them.
And what kind of things do you think work for? Like, how do you think we reach people who are either not engaged, who are Democrats who stayed at home, and the people who are, Obama to Trump voters? Do you think that they have different needs? Do you think that they have overlapping needs, messaging?
I think their needs are similar in that some studies suggest that a lot of Trump support is rooted in racial resentment, but some of it's also rooted in, I think they just wanted to see some of them.
Right.
With the racial resentment. I don't think that discounts racial resentment, but I also wanted to see what the quote-unquote leadership, something bold, bombastic, shocking. Yeah. But I think it was just something bold. Like, just say something that's different, that's not vanilla, that even whether it's indifference is always good, as we see. But I think for some people, it's the fact that he was saying different or confirming their own biases or even if he would articulate bad solutions, aside from his problems with immigrants, some of the problems he articulated with sort of trade deals and the way they impact regular people and stuff were like not, those are clear problems that we have to address. Yes. It doesn't mean blow up the whole world order, but let's fix it. Anyway, so I think
when just I said blow up the system, I meant get rid of status quo.
I agree with you. And I think it's really about how do we give people something bold that relates to their everyday life, that says, I am seen, I am heard. This leader cares about what I'm dealing with.
Right. So it's the opposite, in the opposite direction. Yeah. It's the you're seen, you're heard, your pain is real. And like, so Trump doesn't care about it, pretended he did. Bernie, I would say, of course, because I like Bernie, does care about it, said that he did. And it was like, I mean, he said something like this yesterday, but it's like, one blames, it's like, I feel your pain, blame Mexicans and Muslims. And one is like, I feel your pain, blame billionaires and millionaires or whatever, which I think is a really significant difference that sometimes people don't see, and they almost equate the two of them because they can reach an overlapping audience. But I think that that's like such an important thing to do, that you don't defeat a right-wing populist with a moderate.
No, you actually can't.
Right. Right. It's just so.
There's no middle. He's an extreme right.
Yeah. How are you going to do that? And what do you think about, like, there's this other argument, this dichotomy or not, I don't know, the racial resentment, and tell me if they're here and you need to leave, but the racial resentment and the economic anxiety stuff, right? So there's this big debate about that, and some people pretend it's only one and some the other.
I struggle because I think folks of color have been poor for a long time.
Right.
And, for example, black women vote 90%+. Like, so I think the economic anxiety explains in part, but if that was wholly the answer, all the folks who experienced economic anxiety would have voted for Trump.
Because you mean the idea is that you're more susceptible to bigotry,
or if economic anxiety is motivating you to vote for Trump, how come the folks who are the most economically anxious in our society historically
didn't
vote for Trump? So I think economic anxiety is a part of it, but to the earlier point about intersectionality, I think we also have to layer on race on top of that.
Do you read Breonna Joy Gray at all?
I need to.
Yeah, she's great. I'll introduce you. You guys should definitely meet online. But she was talking about this with Mehdi Hasan from The Intercept, this debate. And again, it's framed often in these ridiculous and either or class or race, right? And she was like, I'm not going to say one is more important, just like I'm not going to compare the Holocaust or slavery. And I thought it was a good comparison to another comparison she wouldn't make. But she was saying that for her, it's like what she thinks is happening is it's not the anxiety, economic anxiety per se, but it's the slipping away, the falling back in line. She doesn't deny that there's racism there, but for her, her thing is that those people need to be spoken to in a way that doesn't throw anyone else under the bus.
We shouldn't forget about them. We should have hard conversations with them, but I think a lot of it is an education thing as well. Yeah. This person is not, but I mean, historically, since Bacon's Rebellion, poor white folks have voted against their interests. So it's not a new phenomenon.
Yes, the question is how.
Done enough work to sit down and actually show people why is it in your best interest to cast your lot with these folks who don't look like you.
Can you do that? You're such a good speaker. Let's put together a panel who can do that and travel around the country.
Doing my best. Yeah. Doing my best.
No, it seems like you obviously are really inspiring and you reach people. And thank you for your...
No, thank you.
I was going to say service, but that sounds too, like, I don't know. It sounds not as... I don't want to say you're a rebel, but you're too... what am I saying? I'm pre-coffee right now, by the way.
No, that's fine.
You're, like, too... inspiring or revolutionary in a way, but not like in a threatening the order way, to just say service. That sounds so vanilla.
Service is kind enough. Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Thank you so much. And where can people find you and you online?
I'm on Twitter at Michael D. Tubbs, MichaelDTubbs.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Of course, climate change was a huge thing, and they talked about the New Green Deal.
Yeah.
Which is a big deal. Speaking of FDR and the New Deal, they have the New Green Deal. I interviewed Naomi Klein.
Wonderful to be with you and to be with this fantastic panel. I guess the first thing I would say is that there are lots of Green New Deals. You know, there isn't this one thing that is the Green New Deal. There is momentum towards the idea of using the scarce time leading up to 2020 to get as specific as possible about what a sweeping intersectional transition would look like if it took science and justice seriously, if it embedded justice in the heart of the scientific imperative to get off of fossil fuels in this epic hurry, right? The IPCC report tells us we have a terrifying 12 years to reduce our fossil fuel use by 45%. And don't let your brain play a trick on you and tell you that that means you can start in 12 years. No, by 12 years, we need to be down by 45%. And by mid-century, we need to be off carbon completely, right? So that means we need to have started yesterday. And this is, I think, why the 2016 election was so devastating to all of us who follow the science, right? And it was devastating to everybody for all kinds of reasons. But what all of us who follow the science know is that we just can't lose these 4 years, right? So I think what is so exciting about the momentum that is building towards creating a select committee, and this is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's proposal to create a select committee that would spend the next year consulting with movement leaders, including climate justice leaders who have come up with this whole model of embedding justice in our climate response, because for far too long, the truth is that the environmental movement didn't do that and didn't think enough about people and sort of had this idea that, you know, because climate change is so important, first we'll save the planet and then we'll worry about poverty and racism and gender exclusion. And, you know, that's a way to build a really small, homogenous movement that is filled with privileged people who don't need transformative change. And in fact are very invested in the status quo, right? I mean, Arundhati Roy, the wonderful novelist, talks about how a lot of environmentalists ask the question, how can we change without changing, right? And if the status quo is working for you, that makes sense, right? Can we do a little carbon trading? You know, can we change our light bulbs? How can we change in a way that that disrupts a system that is working for me and my friends as little as possible, right? And I think the great wisdom of the environmental justice movement and the climate justice movement for all these years has been to say that actually the people who are the least threatened by the kind of systemic change that science is now demanding, and the IPCC report is very clear, and that just lest we overlook it, they made it their very first line of the summary of the IPCC report, that what is required now is transformation of every aspect of society. In other words, a political revolution, right? And, you know, when I first started writing about the fact that capitalism and climate were in conflict, I got a lot of pushback from our friends in the environmental movement who would say things to me like on the down low, like, why are you making our jobs harder? You know, climate change is hard enough. Well, why do we have to make it about capitalism? And my response was always, actually, capitalism isn't working for a huge number of people on this planet. And if we can come up with a framework for responding to climate change that is actually a challenge to economic inequality, joblessness, economic precarity, the need for Medicare for all, and the rest of it, then actually we're going to build a much broader movement, and also a movement that will fight harder because it has so much to gain. Because not only is it not threatened by systemic change, it's hungry for it, right? So in terms of your question of where did this come from, I mean, frankly, I don't really know. It's come together really, really quickly. But I think the exciting part about the timeline, looking at the resolution, is that it sets a deadline of January 2020 to come up with a plan for a Green New Deal, right? That is simultaneously a plan to virtually eliminate poverty, a huge jobs program that touches on transportation, agriculture, energy, housing. And this is the problem with the way we've traditionally dealt with climate change, I think, in the past, is that it has been so siloed. We're always looking for that sort of magic bullet. And so this creates a framework for all of these different sectors to talk together. I think by using the phrase New Deal, it reminds us that there is a historical precedent for responding to collective crisis with transformational change. But it should also be a reminder that first New Deal didn't have enough justice embedded in the center by any means. And there were many people who were excluded by design, many African-American workers. You know, the 30s were a period when a huge number of Mexicans were deported to eliminate competition from white workers in the United States. Domestic workers were excluded from so many New Deal era policies, agricultural workers. So this New Deal has to be not only green, but for everybody, right? And so you've got this timeline, which conveniently is at the beginning of the 2020 cycle. And if there is, you know, a truly participatory process that draws on the wisdom of these movements that have been developing this idea for so long, and the local governments that are already trying to build it in miniature, and the best scientists and all the best knowledge and the best practices around the world, then that means that there could be a plan that really, it comes from this interplay between movements working from below and this exotic thing of having a critical mass of politicians who are not afraid of transformational change. And it could form the basis of a people's platform in 2020. And any candidate who wanted to run as a progressive would need to run on the Green New Deal.
Why do you think, like, it's in everyone's self-interest on some level, right, to combat climate change, to deal with climate change? Like, someone who has a kid now, someone who has a grandchild, like, what do you think is going through someone's head when they oppose, when they say climate change isn't real, when they do whatever Trump does, when they do whatever moderate Dem does, whatever they do that doesn't treat this as an emergency, what do you think is going through their head in terms of their own self-preservation or their own children's futures or grandchildren's
futures? So I think those are different questions, like what somebody who's actively denying climate change is doing versus somebody who doesn't deny it but isn't treating it like an emergency. So I'm going to tackle that one first, which is I think that, frankly, you can't deal with climate change as an individual, right, in any meaningful way. Like, you can do things to symbolically lower your personal carbon footprint, but if you really do understand the scale of the disaster and how quickly we need to lower our emissions, you know that the choices that you make as an individual are meaningless in the scheme of things, right? So those choices would only be meaningful if they were in the context of a sort of wartime level mobilization that had a plan, you know, for where all the pieces fit together and what our targets were and how we were going to do this together. And that's what we haven't had. So I think in some sense it is reasonable in the absence of a plan that is commensurate with the crisis to think that it doesn't really matter. you know, because I think for there were decades when people dutifully changed their light bulbs and, you know, dutifully did all the like green things in their homes and recycled. And then they looked around and they're like, wait a minute, right. You know, we have a so-called green president who's, you know, opening up new fracking and frontiers and saying it's okay to drill in the Arctic. Like, that doesn't make sense, right? So I think there's a way in which it's perfectly rational to think that what you do as an individual doesn't matter in this fight. It doesn't. What matters is what we do as a collective. And that's why this is an ideological battle, because we are up against an ideology that actually doesn't believe in collective action, that thinks there's something wrong with planning and economy. And we need to. We really, really need to, because you do not get off of fossil fuels in the timeline that we have without a plan, you know, without a very serious industrial strategy. You can have an ideological battle about whether or not you like planning or not, but that doesn't change the fact that you will not achieve this without a plan. The other half of it, which is, you know, the people who are outright denying climate change.
Or claim to be denying, right?
Or claim to be denying.
Groups there, too, right?
Absolutely, there are. I think there are many people who use denial. I don't think Donald Trump has any doubt that climate change is happening. You know, he knows it's impacting his golf courses. Right. Mar-a-Lago is going to be underwater, you know. He does know that. But I believe that his wealth will protect him, that he will be able to buy his way out of it. We know that a lot of very wealthy people are investing in all kinds of privatized disaster protections. I mean, Kim and Kanye had a private, you know, fire force protecting their house during the California fires. And that's something I wrote about, you know, 10 years ago that's been happening. So,
and you saw the Yes Men, right? The Yes Men Save the World, when they have like a survive, they go present their survival ball or something.
The survival ball. I forgot about that.
We want something that's going to be able to save a human being no matter what Mother Nature throws at them. And so this is the answer. This is the Halliburton Survivaball.
No, but even the things that the real world things that I think very wealthy people think are going to protect them, you know, are by no means, you know, a guarantee.
Right.
But we saw this after Superstorm Sandy in New York, that luxury, luxury condominium building started marketing the fact that they had, their own generators and I mean, some of them had like submarine style doors and I mean moats. This is part of, you know, real estate for the super rich right now is storm protection, that at the same time as you have economic austerity for everybody else, you can see how these ideas can coexist, how you can starve the public sphere and think you're all right. But I think there's something deeper in that. I think that climate change is such a fundamental threat to the entire Republican project that you have to deny the reality of climate change. Because if you have a worldview that is all about deregulation, privatization, cutting your taxes, cutting the public sphere, I mean, it can't survive for a minute up against the reality of climate change. We need massive investments in the public sphere. We need to regulate corporations and tell them they can't do the things that are destabilizing our climate. We need to plan our economy. We need to break every single one of their sacred rules. And that's just not viable. And they have a very profitable political project, and they're going to protect it. So I don't think they're just protecting their fossil fuel interests and the fossil fuel interests of their funders. I think that's part of it, but I actually think it's a smaller part of it than the broader threat that it poses to their entire worldview. And I even think it's deeper than that, in the sense that I think that there's a reason why climate change denial is strongest in the United States, Australia, and some parts of Canada, like Alberta. I mean, I think that in settler colonial states, which are all about this idea of infinite wilderness to dominate, as a response, frankly, to Europe hitting up against its ecological limits. I mean, that was the whole idea of quote unquote New England. Like, hey, we found a New England, you know? And so there's like, it's so fundamentally about overcoming the idea that there are any natural limits to the quest for profit.
Right.
That if you were going to accept the reality of climate change, it means that you're accepting the fact of ecological limits. And so it's a narrative crisis. It's a crisis of worldview and ideology.
Right.
And so I don't find it surprising that people deny it.
I actually got a really interesting interview with a security guard in the hotel I was staying at. It was really interesting because I got home from the first day of the conference and I got home to the hotel and I started speaking with the security guard who asked me where I was from. And then I asked him where he was from and he said Louisiana. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. What brought you here? And he was like, actually, it was kind of Bernie Sanders who brought me here. And then he explained that he had a lot of unfortunate experiences in Louisiana. And he needed to...
Why? It seems like such a lovely state.
Such a lovely state. Actually, adjacent, very close to the Paperboy location with the Everglades. And he actually said, he was like, partly I came because of Bernie Sanders, because I felt like someone who was the mayor of the city, and this was in Burlington, the Sanders Institute gathering, he felt like someone who would be elected, someone, a place that would elect someone like Bernie Sanders would have more compassion than other cities. He was very eager to talk. And I said, do you want to do an interview? And he said, yes. And I went upstairs and I got my microphone and we did an interview. And he told some really fascinating stories about that. And he's one of these people who's like incredibly insightful and intellectual and astute and grew up raised by very strong Christians. And he talked about becoming non-Christian, becoming an agnostic and an atheist. And the thing that made him do that, he says, was that he was speaking in tongues one day when he was a teenager. And
I never learned how to do that. I'd love to try.
I know. We could do it.
Well, I'll look up some YouTube videos and figure out how they do it, and then I'll...
Well, apparently, according to him, it's very easy to do. And he was saying he just faked it.
Sure.
And...
It's like scatting for Jesus.
Yeah, it is. It's scatting for Jesus. And he faked it, and he said that it was while he was faking it and people were looking at him as if it were real that he realized what BS it was, and that was something that made him start to question God, and now he's an atheist. So it was an interesting way to kind of tie in what we were talking about.
Can you tell me your name, whatever, to the extent of which you want to tell your name?
Sure. We'll go with first name. Sean.
Sean, okay. And you do, what do you do?
So there. Well, security guard.
Okay, so tell me where you're from and what brought you to Vermont.
Okay, so it's a long story. Louisiana. I'm from Louisiana, and it's a variety of reasons. I'd have to say, being in Louisiana wasn't a pleasant experience for me. Growing up, I had plenty of family issues, that sort of thing, that negatively impacted, my education.
Where in Louisiana, by the way?
You know Duck Dynasty?
I haven't watched it, but I know what it is, yeah.
I'm from where they're from.
Which is what?
West Monroe.
I heard you just say they from. That was a little Louisianian, right?
Maybe. I think it depends. Okay.
How close is that to New Orleans or Baton Rouge?
Pretty far. Okay. Honestly, it'd be quicker to go through Mississippi to get to New Orleans than it would be to drive through Louisiana from there.
So what is, I'm so bad at geography, but we're talking about Northeast.
Northeast.
Oh, okay, I said that. Okay. Got it. Northeast. All right. So I cut you off, sorry, but you were in Louisiana. You said it's some negative stuff that affected your education.
Well, it started, at least back as far as five, typical family divorce, that sort of thing. Honestly, there's a lot of stuff in there, some of which some people might find hard to believe that happened. Least of which is negligent behavior. They were more interested in, fighting with each other than they were raising the kids. So, those being the least of my problems during that time period, it led to me not really focusing that much on school, even in middle school and high school, to the point to where I would typically go from advanced classes or AP classes, and instead of doing the homework, I would just drop down to an easier class where I knew I didn't have to work and I could just get, a 3.0 or something.
Right.
So that was typically how I handled my problems, was just go do something easier. And eventually, I graduated high school and I had to like actually start trying to be an adult and trying to fix things and solve things. And so the first thing I really did was, even though I was like in college, I focused more on learning about news and politics and that sort of thing to try to figure out what it was that I believed. In high school, my family was, you know, deeply religious. Mm. And I eventually came to the conclusion that, you know, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't really believe in the things that they believed in. So that kind of ostracized me for a bit. And
how'd you realize it?
Well, I was in a youth group, and they were praying for everyone to be able to speak in tongues. And I eventually was able to do it. And I realized that I was just speaking gibberish.
Right.
And so
wow.
My thought process was kind of along the lines of, well, this is doubt. This is obviously something God wouldn't be too happy of. If this was really a gift he was giving me and I showed like this kind of doubt in his gift, would I really still be able to do it? And
right.
Then the other thing was like, I just, you know, kind of like guessed at it, just, you know, babbled a little bit.
Right. Whatever. And so no one saw through it. So you're like, this is BS,
yeah.
Maybe.
And so, like, I think there was a moment where I made eye contact with the preacher and I was having this realization of, like, I don't believe any of this.
Right.
And I think he kind of recognized it, because at that point I was at the center of the group where everyone were laying their hands on me to try to help me receive the gift.
Uh-huh.
And I just kind of stopped.
Wow.
You know, maybe this isn't what I thought it was.
Like, you stopped right there? Or, like, you mean you stop, you, like...
I gave it a few sentences of, you know, speaking in tongues.
Yeah.
And then I was like, yeah, maybe this isn't real.
And so, was it dramatic depart? Like, was everyone like, what's going on? Or did you just go about... Did you just leave kind of, like, subtly?
No. I think maybe enough sentences were spoken that people thought that it worked. And
right.
The pastor maybe realized quickly enough that... it was time to move on, so, like, it didn't really strike anyone as
right.
odd.
So what does moving on mean?
Moving on with a sermon, like, going and praying for somebody else, putting your hands on somebody else, and having, just moving on
right.
with the whole
so
thing.
So he's like, okay, that's good, next person? Like,
yeah.
How do it work?
Obviously not those words, but, you know,
yeah.
It's just a lot of, like, speaking in tongues. Like, a lot of the times, the adults, especially the more experienced and practiced, will often speak in tongues. And that honestly, there's no better way to, like, get a message across than to say that you said something deeply profound that no one can understand.
Right.
So
right.
It's fairly easy to have a deep, meaningful session, I guess, if you want to call it that, deep, meaningful ceremony.
Right.
If people just believe that you said something
right.
worthwhile.
Yeah. And how old were you at this point?
13, maybe 14.
Oh, okay. And so then what did you do?
I didn't stop believing immediately.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a thing of like, this doesn't feel right, and I have doubts now. And I honestly came to the conclusion that my relationship with God was an unhealthy one, and that if it was going to be a real, genuine relationship, then, you know, it would have to be two-sided. He would have to reach out to me and talk to me.
Right.
And that's kind of what I wanted. Like, I wanted to hear the voice in my head, the voice of God talking to me, and it just never happened. And that, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful for never having heard the voice now
right.
that I have a different perspective. But at the time, it was a very unsettling, scary, and I honestly felt a bit guilty over the whole situation. And, you know, maybe like I did something wrong, or maybe there was something wrong with me.
Right. So you left Louisiana, and
mm-hmm.
then you. How did you decide where to go?
Like, the whole deal is, like, Vermont does have... I see Vermont as going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I would have liked to have seen a Democratic governor this last election so that I could have my health care sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Vermont is now a more attractive place for liberal people, and as more people move here, it's going to become more and more liberal faster.
Right.
And it's going to be easier to get things like Medicare for all. And to be honest, like, I wasn't necessarily entirely aware of the political situation of Vermont. I just knew it leaned more liberal. So I was still taking a huge risk. I mean, I did research, but I also was like, I was on my edge. Like, I'm done. Like, I'm leaving, and anywhere is better than here. I need something different. I need something new and better in my life.
So you come here and you're homeless for how long?
I was on the streets for 2 weeks, where I finally got into the homeless shelter for cots. That lasted about 3 months, and I'm in transitional housing now. So I am in the process of still like trying to get into a house, but I've technically been housed for the most of the time that I've been here.
Okay.
According to the state of Vermont, I do have I have been in a home since I got into the homeless shelter, which it's very technical. Like, it didn't feel like home, and you do have to leave the shelter for most of the day. You cannot stay after 8 a.m., and you could not come back until after 6:15 p.m.
So what would you do during the day?
Well, it depends on who you are and what you have
going
on.
What would you do personally?
At first, nothing. Like, I would go to the day station and just sit there all day listening to YouTube videos.
What's
trying.
What's the day station? I don't even know what that means.
There are two stations here with cots. The day station is where you go during the day, where you can get shelter from the rain and stuff during the day. The way station is where they offer beds to people. The way station is a lot harder to get into. Anyone can walk into the day station, but there are a limited number of beds, and they do have safety concerns and stuff like that. So they do restrict the amount of people who can go to the mm-hmm. way station. Honestly, like the whole being homeless thing, it's a lot more difficult of a topic than people really understand, especially until you've either been on one side or the other, because there are a lot of concerns and risks. And I think it's a really hard situation to understand, even if you're going through mm-hmm. it. But honestly, I think that you have to decide what you think is moral in this case. Do you think it's moral to let these people stay outside, even though they obviously have these issues? Do you think that you should, you think that that's the right thing to do? Because in your mind, you think there has to be a limit. In my mind, I think Utah has it right.
What do they do?
They have, basically, they build housing for the homeless. Like, I think from what I understand, it's the lowest barrier to entry for home for anyone. I think they, I'm not as familiar on this as I should be for bringing it up, but the basic idea is like, it's rent free. You don't have to pay for anything at first. It's not great housing. Like, it's just meant for you, and it's meant to help you get on your feet. You go in, you don't have to pay anything for a while. You can clean up, you can get comfortable, you can get sober, and you can get a job. You can get set up. You can have people who help you orient yourself and help you find a job. And eventually when you do find a job, after you've worked long enough, they will start charging you rent at a discounted rate. It won't be like luxury rates or anything. Like, this housing is meant to be temporary, not temporary, but it's meant to be for people who are struggling and getting back on their feet. In my mind, I think that the reason why I might sound conservative is because I think that even the Vermont solution is a very conservative solution. In my ideal world, we would have enough housing for everybody, and there would be government-supplied housing. And I would be open to hearing any sort of thing. Like, I honestly think that you have to be willing to give someone a chance, even if it seems like it's not worth it. So I do honestly think that even these people who are causing problems for cots should be put in housing of some sort, should be given their own private space and treated like a human being.
Kind of maybe the most interesting in a way of all the interviews I got, because the speakers were spending a lot of time talking about poverty and about inequality and, you know, what people are going through. So it was an interesting way to kind of tie in what we were talking about. And I think that's it. And we're going to see you soon. Anyway, so yeah, this was a great, I thought, a great conference. I'm glad I could share it with listeners. I'm glad I could share it with you, Gabe.
I'm glad to find out that it happened.
Yeah, I think we learned a lot. We learned a lot about how bad neoliberalism is.
I think, hey, tune into any episode.
And we make that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. We learned a lot about how good Sanders is.
Tune into any episode.
We learned a lot about how you can't separate race and class.
Hey, guess what?
Every episode, yeah. Well, is there anything new you'd like to share about anything? Observations about love, life, loss?
I feel pretty good about everything happening in my life right now. You can always come see me every Wednesday at 10 p.m. at Pete's Candy Store for Funhouse Comedy live. And this Friday, I have to go get the information now. I'll be right back.
Okay.
Hey, and December 14th, I am going to be hosting a live variety sketch show called Sofa Kingdom. And it is going to be, you can watch us live on Facebook Live, Sofa Kingdom. And it's starting at 8 p.m. on December 14th. And also check out Eat, Pray, Judge, which is a film review podcast that I do with my old roommate, Sammy Hamarne.
And December 14th is a Friday?
That's a Friday.
Okay, awesome. Okay. You can always tune into the Katie Halper Show on iTunes, on SoundCloud. If you want to follow us on social media, I'm on Twitter and on Instagram. I'm KT Halps. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. You can use the hashtag KT Help Show. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S-H-O-W. You can find us on Facebook. Gabe, you're Gabe underscore Pacheco.
That's right.
And I think that's it. And we're going to see you soon. By the way, just so you know, we got great future guests coming down the pike. We got Aida Chavez from The Intercept. We got Ted Alexandro, very funny comedian. We got Johan Hari. A really great writer who writes a lot about depression and addiction. So we think you're really going to like this. And make sure you become Patreon subscribers, because on this week's episode, we offer you the rest of that interview with Naomi Klein. So you will not regret it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Bye, guys. See you next week.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.